This podcast is brought to you by Innovid and their Harmony Initiative. Innovid believes that TV should be open for everyone and controlled by no one. And the time to make that vision a reality is now. That's why Innovid created Harmony, an industry-wide initiative to address the biggest challenges facing CTV advertising today. By optimizing at the infrastructure level, Harmony aims to improve efficiency, enhance transparency and control, and increase ROI, all while reducing carbon emissions and providing better viewing experiences for all. Find out more and get involved at innovid.com/harmony. Welcome to the Marketecture Podcast. I'm Ari Paparo. I am joined today by Eric Franchi and Stefan Pretorius, who is the CTO of WPP and whom I have personally known for, we're going on 30 years pre-ad tech. Stefan, thank you for being here.
It's wonderful to be here. Nice to see you again, Ari.
So we'll talk about how we know each other in a moment. Just a quick housekeeping. So this week's vendor interview is with Equativ, which is the new name for a smart ad server. It's an interesting interview with their CRO about how they're investing in SSP, DSP, and curation. So there's a lot going on with that company you may not have heard of. It's definitely worth listening to, and it's free from behind the paywall until Monday. All right, let's jump in. So, Stefan, you and I know each other from around the year 2000, and that is about 4 or 5 years before I was in ad tech. So many people do not think I had a life before ad tech. I was just born in the DoubleClick headquarters. But actually, I'm a lot older than that. And during the dot-com boom, we worked together. Do you want to tell the audience, you know, how we know each other?
I'm not sure it's gonna bathe either of us in glory. I was starting a digital advertising and lead generation business called Acceleration at the time, and you, Ari, as you remember, were trying to flog a software platform called Blink. I think it was called, right?
Blink,
where you could upload your bookmarks, and as you move between browsers and computers, you'd be able to save your bookmarks. Yeah, obviously, Google solved that problem a few years later, and that, you know, whole business model disappeared. But it was fun times, because we figured out how to do large scale lead generation, track results, do attribution modeling. And so in many ways, I mean, it's like, even though they might sound like errand schemes now, they teach you a lot about the fundamentals and the basics of our industry, right?
Yeah, I was in the bookmark business. I was flogging bookmarks. But the secret to our bookmark business is that it was really a spam business. We would basically get people to sign up for bookmarks. And the only way we really could monetize them was by sending them like 6 emails a week with different offers about, hey, add this, you know, money saving scheme to your bookmarks, or hey, golf.com, you to golf, add that to your bookmarks. It was really desperate times.
Early signals business, I would say. You know, I mean, today it would be a signal-driven AI business, you know, with a backed by an LLM, you know, would have scraped all the content of all the bookmarks and created a personal GPT for everyone based on those bookmarks. You know, it had legs. You just didn't know.
Before we move on, what was our co-host Ari like as a 20-something-year-old?
Don't want to embarrass him, but quite a lot skinnier.
Yeah, it's true. I was pretty skinny.
he was the cool guy. He was the cool kid of the digital, you know, early .com days. He had this great Campbell soup tattoo on his arm. He was like, you know, he had swagger. I mean, still, he was pretty intimidating to lots of people, even in like a rented, you know, sort of Regis office in the Bear Stearns building, right?
Yeah, that is accurate. One also side note, many people know this, but my co-founders at Blink, they were from the finance world. They went on to found Two Sigma and are now billionaires. Anyway, I'm here as a podcast host. All right, let's get to the real subject we want to talk about. I bet if a lot of our listeners don't even know that WPP has a CTO. Like, that it's sort of like WPP CTO. Huh, that's interesting. I didn't know they had that. What's your job?
My God. So I've been CTO for 5 years. I sold that same business I started when I worked with you, Ari, to WPP in 2012. It became an ad tech, martech, SI eventually. You know, we implemented everything from, you know, DoubleClick to Omniture to, you know, ExactTarget, and then all the sort of subsequent, you know, parents of those companies. So we sold that business to WPP in 2012, ran it here for a couple of years. And then in 2018, Mark Reed, our CEO, asked me to become CEO for the group. You know, so it's been 5 years, but you're right. Historically, agency holding companies didn't really have centralized technology strategies. You know, they effectively allowed all the agency brands individually to decide what they build, what they buy, you know, how they innovate. And I think, you know, it was sort of not a moment too soon, because, you know, even back in 2018, you know, we already had the early sort of showings of, you know, what AI is going to do to content, at least at that time, content perception, labeling, things like that. A lot of, you know, AI-driven prediction systems and recommendation systems coming on board. And so, you know, I sort of started working really furiously 5 years ago on what does an integrated platform and strategy look like for an agency holding company. You know, what's amazing about the past 5 years' experience is that it's really an exercise in mapping the transformation of our industry and our category to a technology solution. So how do you build software that actually allows you to service both the business you have today, but also allows you to transition into the business you're going to have 5 years from now? You know, all of you have built, you know, software yourself, so you know how difficult it is just to get like one set of requirements out and get people to use it and so on. But to build a platform that's effectively flexible enough to accommodate that transition, while at the same time supporting multiple different versions or configurations of our service offering to clients, was actually remarkably difficult intellectually. I mean, technically not that hard, but intellectually very hard. You know, so some clients only buy one thing from us. They only buy PR services from us, or they only buy production services from us, or only CRM. But then other clients, like, you know, Coca-Cola, buy everything that we do from us end to end. And, you know, so you have like 6,000 people in WPP working on the Coke account, doing everything from audience research to media buying and activation through to creative production, CRM, and everything in between. That's what I've been doing. And maybe because if you haven't heard that much from me, is because I've been super busy executing that. hopefully now with all my AI keynotes at VTC and Next and things like that, I'm maybe, you know, getting out a little bit more. But
well, I think there's this feeling that when agencies invest in tech, it's around orchestration tech, where you're saying, well, you know, we're going to license an ad server from this company and an analytics server from this company, and then the tech we're going to build is coordination, piping, you know, overlays on top of that. How true is that versus building original tech?
No, I think that's a slightly legacy view of the world. I think what's happened in the last, you know, particularly the last few years, but certainly, you know, tracing back even further, is that all the large holding companies have realized that they need to have tools and platforms that differentiate themselves, not only in terms of how they deliver for clients and, you know, and the impact that that work has, but also how they work with clients. In other words, how they engage with them, intake work, track work, etc. So, you know, if you look across the category, all our peers have invested in something like this, you know, or some form of this kind of strategy in the last few years. So we spend about $300 million a year on internal original technology. And that's a combination of product, data, and research. So, and the research is mostly on the AI side. And we, you know, we've invested very seriously in capabilities to do that. So we bought an AI research lab here in London called Satalia. There are about 200 people now, but, you know, research grade sort of AI researchers from UCL, you know, like sort of friends of Demis, you know, sort of vintage, right? And, you know, that's enabled us to do kind of really, really original research in applied AI, but also, you know, obviously in the product development of, you know, for what we do. So our platform, you know, it's built on hyperscaler technology, but our platform is entirely, you know, built from scratch, you know, by ourselves. And then all the studios that we use for creative production, media, CRM, et cetera, is effectively tools that we've built ourselves to not only suit the way that we work with our clients, but also to effectively go further than the regular SaaS and MarTech that's out there at the moment.
Yeah, let's talk numbers first. So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the publicly disclosed numbers that you're investing $318 million annually in AI. And yeah, in contrast, the only other holding company I was able to find that gave a number was Publicis, who says that they're doing $325 million over 3 years. So that's like one-third the investment. And meanwhile, yeah, the other ones like Dentsu really were putting out press releases like, hey, we're working with NVIDIA, congratulations. There was nothing really to it. Are those numbers accurate?
Yeah, they're accurate. They're completely accurate. I mean, you know, we're a publicly listed company, so we can't make these things up. We have to, you know.
Okay, sure.
We're not a major not a venture backed company. You can say whatever they want. No. It's that they are real. And, you know, to put it in context, right? I mean, that's 2% of net sales, right? You know, and you could argue that is still probably underinvesting in a transformational technology. If you say that AI is going to fundamentally transform the entire, you know, marketing services industry, and, you know, one of the leading companies in the space is spending 2% of net sales on that impact, you know, the question is that enough? You know, we are delivering like absolute gangbusters right now and going super fast. I mean, I personally can't really, you know, basically consume or manage much faster pace right now, to be honest. But time will tell. And I think it'll be interesting to look back in a few years' time to see, did we invest enough?
Right. Well, let's talk about the use cases and what you're investing in. There was a very good article that featured you in Ad Age this week that talked through a lot of things. But let's kind of go through. Let's start with creative. What do you see as the opportunity in creative? Obviously, that's kind of the first thing that comes to mind for a lot of people with AI.
Yeah, and I think what's kind of confusing about this stuff is that, you know, if you think about the basic kind of image generation, generative AI use case, people think that, you know, in an agency like WPP, we have, you know, thousands of people who sit around, you know, taking photographs and doing video shoots and things like that all day. Nothing could be further from the truth, right? I mean, most of that is subcontracted to production companies or to specialist, you know, studios and things like that. You know, we do have a production business, Hogarth, which is about 6,000 people. It's a large kind of, you know, tier one production business, largest commercial production business in the world. And so we use AI a lot, but it's a combination of generative AI and virtual production technologies to create content. So instead of, you know, building a car, taking it to the desert, filming it, and then making an ad, you can just take the CAD model, you know, render it in 3D and Omniverse, add a generative background, you know, make it move, and then create the ad and put it out. So there's a shift in production from physical to virtual production. So that's the first.
Let me just interrupt you there. How much of that is real right now versus, like, that's the vision for where it's going?
It's completely real. I mean, by the middle of the year, our largest auto client will have all their car configurators run through that pipeline in live consumer-facing content. We already have a car configurator for BYD that was made exactly like that. We have, you know, several other deals, you know, or projects in flow, you know, right now for delivering that. So this is, I mean, that's completely real. I mean, this is not a fictitious kind of pipeline, right?
Post-production in terms of, you know, maybe the stuff that the ad tech audience is excited about in terms of optimization, personalization, all of that stuff. How much of that is, you know, real versus versus pipeline, or, you know, sort of like actual versus pipeline?
I think when people think about, when they say creative, you know, they mean different things. If you ask agency creative directors what they mean by creative, they will say it's ideas, it's concepts, it's an inspiration, it's a way to position a product in the marketplace, product, you know, how to relate a product to an audience, how to position it in culture. And then ultimately there's a hero piece of content. There's like a hero, you know, sort of, you know, this is the kind of style we're looking for. But then production is the process of taking that core concept and hero, you know, sort of asset, and then, you know, transcreating it into 100 languages and adapting it to, you know, 1,000 different channels and formats, and doing vertical and horizontal, and doing, you know, things for billboards and things for print ads. And, you know, it's like, I mean, you know, all that work, the whole content proliferation from that fans out from the core idea, that's the production business. Now, production is about, it's less than 10% of our total revenue, you know, but it's an important part where generative AI is having a big impact. But Gen AI is also having a massive impact in ideation, right? So tools to make you think differently about things, tools to test ideas, tools to have different perspectives, you know, from different audience groups or from different personas, you know, that's all being done through generative AI. So last year, we rolled out internally a creative studio product, which is like a Gen AI sandbox with about 50 different tools in four marketing functions, from, you know, reinterpreting the brief to coming up with, you know, shower thoughts, you know, net new ideas about things, to building personas, to, you know, evaluating, summarizing documents, you know, all these kind of things. The key thing is, right, and this is the way I think we are really differentiating, is that using our Satalia research team, we've built this kind of concept of the four core brains of marketing. And brains are really just AI services, right? And the four are a brand brain, an audience brain, a channel brain, and a performance brain. And what these are effectively AI representations of a brand, an audience, a channel, or, you know, how that will work all together in actual performance. And so, you know, simplistically, you know, if I was speaking to Ari over a pint, he would say, oh, well, that's just a model, right? I said, yes, of course it's a model, but it's a model with lots of data that's been validated, that's been exposed as a service that can be consumed in software, right? And so let me give you an ad tech example, just to kind of bring it back to the core audience here. One of the most impactful applications in ad tech is not to do DCO live, but to simulate DCO and understand the best performing variants before you go live. Right. So you basically take a performance model that says there are 100 content features, you know, from the text to the logo to the composition to the color schemes, et cetera, that link to some kind of performance metric, so brand lift studies, for instance, that allows you to build a model that says that creates both a recommendation as well as explainability. So this variant will work better than that variant because 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If you want this variant to work better, expose the logo at the end for another 5 seconds, you know, change the position of the product, make the brand bigger, you know, whatever the case is. Now, when you've got a normal DCO process, right, you would spend the first X million impressions optimizing your million variants down to the high performing ones, right? Which means you've got underperforming media impressions. But if you run that entire process on the model beforehand, you only go live with a content that you know is going to perform well.
Right. And that solves a big problem for DCO.
Solves a massive problem for DCO. And I mean, that's what we launched at Google Next last week with in Thomas's keynote. And it's the thing, you know, there's nothing generative in it. It's perception, right? It's the opposite. It's the flip side of generative AI, which is machine perception. But it's a massively useful, you know, use case in advertising.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Let's move on from creative to media planning. Sir Martin Sorrell spoke at the AdTech Investor Conference that both Eric and I were at yesterday. And he specifically called out WPP. I just want to mention that. He said WPP has 45,000 people in media planning, and AI could currently do their job better than they could. That's a paraphrase of what he said. I'm not going to ask you to respond to that. And then he gave some anecdotes about hanging out with Vladimir Putin. So that's how he rolls.
That's appropriate.
Anyway. Media planning does seem like an area where it's all numbers, it's all data, you have a ton of historical data. Seems pretty ripe to have fewer human beings doing it and more machines. So what are you doing in that area?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge area, right? I mean, I think what's I think the first thing I will just want to say is that not all AI is generative AI, and not all useful things you do with numbers and formulas, you know, is necessarily algorithms, is necessarily AI, right? So there's lots of problems in media which are just like basically discrete mathematics, you know, optimization problems. They're not necessarily AI problems, right? So we have a little bit of an industry definitional problem that everyone wants to call everything generative AI, or they want to solve every problem through generative AI, which is, you know, not always, you know, the case. But what I would say is on the media side, which I find the most exciting, is that besides the kind of creative optimization and content intelligence, is this whole notion of finding more accurate and better theories of relevance or indicators of relevance, right? So this whole idea of, you know, you can only be effective in media planning and buying if you know who someone is, I think is, you know, has to be completely debunked, right? So this notion of, if I know who you are, then I can be relevant to you, is actually a fallacy, because very often who you are is a far weaker indication of what your needs and desires are than where you are, what time of day it is, what's the context that you're in, right? So you might behave entirely differently when you're at the football on a Saturday afternoon in the stadium than when you're sitting at home, you know, with your wife watching series, you know, 11 o'clock versus when you're in a superstore at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning, right? Same person, same demographic details, same identifiers, right? Same person in the CRM database, but your context and what you open to is entirely different. I mean, for us, the things that I'm the most excited about is the areas where we've managed to use things like occasion-based targeting, right? Or a combination of time, space, and other contextual, you know, signals to understand what will resonate with people. And what I love about that is that all that work is done at kind of a cohort or aggregate level, right? I mean, sometimes in these sort of, you know, these sort of cells of maybe like half a mile, right? It's they're not sort of small cells. But for many of our clients, one-to-one is a complete fallacy, right? I mean, if you're selling fizzy drinks or you're selling, you know, kind of washing powder, I mean, you know, no one wants to receive, you know, a direct email from, you know, you're washing up liquid, right? I mean, it's like, it's not the case. You know, this super exciting stuff happening on the one-to-one side as well, and all the kind of the clean room stuff we've always been doing, and all the, you know, the kind of the data matching and all the probabilistic matching and all the federated learning. I mean, all those things are great. But for me, it's like it's the new theories of how can you be relevant to someone that I find the most interesting.
Sure. No, I get that. So the other area that Sir Martin called out, not to just toot his horn, but I thought it was pretty interesting. He said one of the biggest opportunities for AI in agencies is knowledge transfer, and that it's a huge inefficiency to get everyone on the team pointing the same direction, knowing the same things, et cetera. And I think your competitor, Omnicom or Publicis, that came out with Claude, and I think people laughed a little bit because it's such a silly name, but that was their first.
You mean Marcel?
Marcel. Was that, Marcel. So, which one was that?
Claude is the Anthropic AI model.
Yeah, Claude is Anthropic.
Yeah, Marcel, I'm sorry. It was like a chatbot that was supposed to get everyone on the same page. So how do you think about that, about knowledge management in a giant corporation like WPP?
I think that's a correct observation. I think in any knowledge based organization, whether it's a law firm or a, you know, a consultancy or a, you know, investment company, I mean, you know, we all trade on knowledge and sort of experience and expertise. Right now, you know, what I think, not to get too philosophical, but I mean, AI is really a technology about intelligence. And so it's one of the first technologies that makes the way we think and the way we process information and the way that our chain of thought works and the way that, you know, different perspectives influence decision making is sort of made overt, right? And so I completely agree with the notion that it's one of the biggest opportunities. And the question is how do you make that kind of organizational change so that not only are your knowledge stores available, but you are building a reinforcement learning into your software so that people are constantly making it smarter, right? So in our creative studio, we have this sort of almost like a creative pin board, you know, for projects where the way that people interact with those things and move things up and down and like them and dislike them and pin them is a reinforcement learning process to actually tell the machine what is good and what is bad. Now, the longer you do that, the better it becomes. I mean, you know, the reason why ChatGPT was so uncannily good so fast is because it had 100 million people training it day and night for the first few weeks, right? So then anything that gets launched feels a little bit like kind of like awkward and a bit like the shy kid, you know, doesn't quite know the social codes, right? Until it gets trained and then it becomes better. And so I think that's the trick, right? Is to basically build a digital twin of your organization through the adoption of reinforcement learning, you know, in the way that people interact with the software.
Yeah, you can imagine a big impact on account management where the client calls up their account person and says, hey, we're thinking about doing digital at home and supermarket checkouts. What do you think? And currently, the account manager may or may not have any ability to answer that question. But I'm sure there's a lot of people at WPP who really could answer that question extremely well and already have. So that there's a huge opportunity there.
Well, and I mean, just to give you one example, practical example of how augmented, you know, people can become through these tools, right? So if I say to you, okay, you work on the Fanta account, right? And I want to know what are the best ways to execute Fanta on TikTok. What are you going to say? But if I say to you, here's the Fanta brand platform playbook, right? It's a 100-page PDF. It's been done by strategists. You know, it tells you exactly how to execute Fanta. It tells you exactly what the proof points are, what the kind of the cut throughs are, et cetera, et cetera. And I then tell you, here's a 200-page TikTok best practice execution guide, right? Now, you can go and read those and then make a whole bunch of notes and, you know, ponder about it the whole weekend. Or what you can do is you can upload both those documents to our Creative Studio and say, at the intersection of these two things, how do I execute the Fanta brand platform on TikTok? It'll give you an amazing set of starting ideas, None of them will be wrong. Some of them will be very good. You could argue none of them are going to be truly inventive because they are within it's maybe interpolation and extrapolation within the boundaries of what they have, but it's not going to be net new invention because it doesn't have the, you know, the ability to do that yet. But for, as you said, I mean, if you're an account person, the client says to you, hey, you know, I feel we're a little bit underweight on TikTok. What's the best way to execute our new brand platform on TikTok? You can come back to the client within 5 minutes with a pretty good answer. That's the real practical example of where good input information, right? So crisp articulations of brands, good understanding of platforms, markets, et cetera, combined with, you know, well-structured AI tools that are safe, secure, et cetera, can get enormous augmentation of outputs.
Right. And clients hate paying for strategy, right? So effectively, you're boiling down a lot of strategy for them.
I'd argue clients hate paying for account management more than anything.
Stefan, are you familiar with the Sam Altman quote about AI and agencies?
I am, yes. It did make its rounds.
So, yeah, I'd imagine. So for the listeners, I'll blow it through fast, and then I'd love your reaction. And I quote from Sam Altman, CEO of OpenAI, 95% of what marketers use agencies, strategists, and creative professionals for today will easily, nearly instantly, and at almost no cost be handled by the AI. And the AI will likely be able to test the creative against real or synthetic customer focus groups for predicting results and optimizing. Again, all free, instant, and nearly perfect. Images, videos, campaign ideas, no problem.
That is the thought experiment, right? That's exactly the thought experiment. And, you know, when we've spoken publicly about this, you know, at a Capital Markets Day early in the year, when we set out on this journey, I mean, we effectively had the sort of three-layer pyramid for our AI strategy. You know, the first one was just get it into productivity software, get everyone, you know, working faster and better. Second layer is put AI into all our products and systems and make sure that we build better tools that differentiate us. The third one is total disruption. Basically, put money in the one end, get results out the other end, and no humans in the process, right? And what you've just described, or what Sam probably extrapolated in his mind there, is effectively that, right? Where there are no brand-side marketers. There's only a CFO that says, I'm going to spend 12% of my gross profit on marketing, and I'm going to feed it into the marketing magic machine, and I'm going to get, you know, results out there then. Now, I think we are, you know, there's another AI entrepreneur who famously said, you know, people both underestimate the pace of change, but also overestimate the pace of impact, right? And to some degree, you know, this is the case with that Sam Altman quote. Theoretically, he is entirely correct. It will take us years to get there practically. Because the process of marketing and the process of you know, commerce and running large brand organizations is way more messy than that. And, you know, I also think that it's not a particularly optimistic or humanistic view of the world, right? Because if that is true of marketing advertising, that's also true of law, finance, consulting, coding, right? And so what do we all do? You know, we sit around eating, you know, eggs and pesto all day, which is, you know, sounds kind of nice, but it's not going to, you know, make us very happy. So I think where he's wrong is that he's sort of analytically right and practically wrong. Technically, it's possible to build systems like that. They will not be free. I massively disagree with him. You know, the capital expenditure of building these systems and the GPUs that support them. You know, if you went to the Jensen Wang, you know, rock concert the other day, you will know these systems are incredibly expensive. So they're going to be monetized, and they will be monetized, you know, through customers. So they won't be free. But could you theoretically automate a lot of what's done in our industry today? I think the answer is yes. But I think you will destroy an entire category of human ingenuity and creativity in the process. And so, you know, I think we have a choice, right? To say we either want to build black boxes that get good results, but basically make us all stupid. Or we can build good software that makes us a lot more effective, augments our creativity, and makes everyone smarter. So it's like, go back to the Middle Ages, you know, and the Inquisition is run by, you know, by the AI entrepreneurs, or do the Renaissance. That's the choice we have. And
what a mic drop.
Yeah, let's call it on that.
Oh my God.
That quote. All right, we're going to take a quick break, come back with News of the Week around TikTok. We're on Meta, Palantir, a lot of exciting news this week. Oh, yeah, and also cookies.
This podcast is sponsored by Adelaide. You've probably heard of Adelaide by now. This month, they announced a new product, Adelaide for Publishers. For the first time, publishers can leverage attention metrics to curate inventory, deliver attention insights, and drive higher CPMs. Join The Weather Company, NPR, Westwood One, Cumulus Media, and other leading publishers taking advantage of the attention economy's most popular metric, AU. Maybe one day Mark will convince me to sell guaranteed AU slots on Marketecture, but probably not. Check out AdelaideMetrics.com/AFP for more information.
And we're back. I'm still reeling from that last quote, Stefan. So work with me, folks. We've got a lot of news this week. So we'll prioritize on the ones that are, you know, it's probably affecting the largest markets, i.e. trillion-dollar companies. So first is, maybe a surprise, maybe no surprise, Google has delayed the deprecation of cookies for the third time. Okay, question number one, surprise or no surprise?
I was on the record saying I thought they would do it on time just because of the embarrassment factor. But most other people I know who are smart were predicting it would be delayed. And they were right. And I was wrong. And it is embarrassing. So I was right about it being embarrassing.
What's most embarrassing about this?
Google announced cookies going away. Now I think we're 3-year anniversary. And the progress has just not been very impressive. I think that it feels to everyone involved like it's a process that's out of control, that Google probably shouldn't be running the process because of their conflicts of interest and their antitrust issues, that the solutions being offered are overly complicated and not necessarily as private as some simpler solutions. And people are just frustrated. It's been going on for so long.
What do you think happens from here? Do you think they kick the can down the road again? Or is Q2 of next year, which is going to come fast, is Q2 of next year like actually going to happen? So, and what happens, what impacts the industry, if anything?
Yeah, I think that at this stage of the process, it comes down to nitty-gritty details in the spec and in the APIs and in the testing. And I'm not really a practitioner anymore, so I'm not doing that. But if you talk to people who are very smart, like Paul Bannister, who are working on this, they are finding problems in terms of latency. There's some issue where it only really works with GAM as an ad server, which is obviously a problem antitrust-wise. And the CMA, the UK competition group, is going to look at these very fine-grained details to see if it gets launched or not. So as a result, I would say that whether it launches or not is not so much a political issue as it's now at the level of a sort of technical issue.
Stefan, any take on this?
Yeah, I mean, look, and just to be precise, right, it's the deprecation of third-party cookies, right?
Right.
Well, since we're all ad tech nerds here, or ex-reformed ad tech nerds, not having certainty for the industry is not great. But I think practically, you know, most large brands and you know, agencies have actually will virtually absorbed the impact in the news and have, you know, several years ago started building solutions to understand kind of, you know, signal accuracy and so on, you know, in different ways. And so I think the market has actually moved significantly on. I mean, there are more implementations of clean rooms and federated learning and things like that now than there probably still are largely scaled third party, you know, cookie solutions or the, you know, yeah. In practical terms, I mean, I'll let Ari comment on the sort of the industry perception and everything else. But I mean, in practical terms, I don't think it's going to have much of an impact on us.
I think people are working on it. There is a lot of activity going on to improve the situation, and giving people another 3 to 6 months is probably helpful. The other thing was that no one was happy at all about this idea that the implementation of the deprecation would be during Q4 for the technical reasons. So that was an issue.
Second announcement, and a bigger announcement, maybe the biggest announcement, Ari, to paraphrase your tweet, is this TikTok bill. So Congress passed and Biden signs a bill that could threaten TikTok in the U.S. ByteDance has until January 19, 2025, again, right around the corner, basically, subject to a 90-day extension if a deal is in process. Otherwise, they face a ban. So this is crazy. This is moving forward. The company, ByteDance, they plan to sue because they don't want to sell, largely because they don't want to relinquish the algorithm. And for, you know, TikTok, the algorithm is everything. So two questions top of mind for me outside of the fact that this is, you know, pretty wild that this is actually moving forward. So number one, who is the potential buyer for this? Because this will probably be like $100 billion price tag. And then number two, if there is no buyer and this disappears, and it's a little tough to figure out exactly how much, the approximately $15 billion of ad revenue, where does that go? So let's talk about question number one. Who is the potential buyer for TikTok in the U.S.?
I think the standard buyers, Meta, Google, et cetera, won't be allowed to buy it.
Right.
So you have to look at who's big enough outside that. I think it was Alex Kantrowitz who suggested Walmart was a good potential target. Oracle comes up with the conversation because they're the hosting provider, but I don't think Oracle has the consumer chops to do it. Those are some ideas. It's a big chunk.
Microsoft to Apple?
Yeah, Microsoft would be an opportunity. I mean, they have a pretty diverse set of businesses under their umbrella right now. GitHub and LinkedIn and all these interesting companies. Could happen. It could be private equity, maybe. I don't know, maybe you just make it public.
That's a very big private equity deal. I think probably the biggest one in the history of private equity.
Yeah, yeah. Stefan, what's your bet?
No, I have no idea. I mean, honestly, it's an unprecedented kind of move. You know, I don't think it's great for geopolitics. I mean, I think it's sort of it sets us back, right? And so from that perspective, I'm sort of, you know, disappointed by the whole thing going through. I mean, the more interesting question for us is where does the ad revenue go, right? And I think if there's a prolonged period of uncertainty, you know, that would obviously be the worst thing for everyone, because then, you know, you simply don't know what kind of longer term commitments to make, right? I mean, I think the, you know, whatever you think about the sort of consumer engagement, you know, impact, I do think the growth of TikTok has been very good for media buyers and for clients, you know, looking for new channels, and for more diversity and more competition in the space. I mean, there's, you know, apart from TikTok, there's only a handful of really large scaled global digital platforms these days, right? So it would be a negative impact on the industry if they went away as a significant player.
I saw a chart in a Semaphore this morning that showed that when TikTok was banned in India, virtually all of the revenue went to Meta, to Instagram. Some went to some local providers, but it was pretty much a flip 100% to Instagram. I don't see that being very different in the U.S. Maybe Snap could pick up some.
Yeah, so the thought experiment is it's, you know, Meta properties, you know, specifically Reels on Instagram. It's potentially YouTube Shorts, which has a, you know, similar experience. A lot of brands just port them directly to YouTube Shorts, and it's Snap. What's interesting about this, you know, from a timing perspective, and we can talk about the next one now, is this had no positive impact on Meta, who reported after the bell last night. So we'll jump right into Meta. So Meta reported $36.46 billion versus $36.16 expected. So that's 20% up, 27% up year over year, and they beat expectations. They now reach across all of the various properties, the family, I think they call it, 3.24 billion users, and other metrics were similarly positive. And the stock dropped at one point last night. It was down 19%. I don't know what it opened at, but like I think the largest potentially one day drop of any company from a market cap perspective because of two things. Number one, soft guidance for the year, and then number two, people didn't like the fact that you know, Zuck said they were, you know, doubling down on AI investments, which is a little hard to, you know, kind of wrap your head around, because on the one hand, I understand that, you know, people felt a little burned by the metaverse investments, but then all of these great results they're posting are largely because of the investments they've already made in AI. So what am I missing here? And how did the TikTok, you know, rumor not help them at all positively?
Sorry. I'm not an expert in public markets, but it seems like madness to me, because if you, such short-term memories, just 2 years ago, or even less, 18 months ago, the Meta stock was getting hammered because of overinvestment in AV, virtual VR, sorry. And it was all the same thing. It was like too much capital investment. It's going to take down the stock. And Zuck pulled this amazing turnaround, and the stock has skyrocketed since, and all the metrics are great. So why not give this guy a little slack here? You know, I think he knows what he's doing, right?
Yeah, I think so. They were getting hammered for overinvestment in VR and, you know, the impact of Apple ATT, which, again, through investments in AI, they turned around everything. And he cut costs, and revenue is outperforming.
So. And in contrast, we have Tesla, which offers a horrendous quarter. Everything bad is happening to Tesla. No one's buying their cars. Everyone hates Elon. They're getting kicked out of China. He has nothing to offer the street. And then he just says, oh, and by the way, we're making a cheaper car, and the stock skyrockets. He has no plans to make a cheaper car. There is no cheaper car underway. It's not launching this year. He's so full of shit. The guy is a known liar, And he just somehow convinced all these people that their stock should be at a, you know, multi-hundred PE ratio. Madness.
I love this. It's almost like it's not a podcast. The thing I would say is kind of, I mean, I had a similar response to you, Eric. I was convinced that of the back of the TikTok news that that Meta would actually rally. And what he's spending money on is basically infrastructure to build open source AI, right? And there's something, you know, there's going to be a direct benefit of all that open source AI on the Meta products, right? The family of products. But there's also a larger, you know, future monetization opportunity. Now, maybe like Ari, I'm not an expert in public markets, so, you know, this is not investment advice or financial analysis. But, you know, certainly it strikes me that from a technology perspective, there's a massive monetization opportunity around the open source AI that he's bringing to market. I mean, Llama 3 is very impressive, extremely capable. They've got a fantastic team there. You know, there's nothing hindering them from building a very significant, you know, sort of ancillary commercial business around the core open source models. So, and ironically, you know, the company that's supplying them, you know, all the GPUs to build this infrastructure is doing very well off the back of this, of these investments, right? So not entirely consistent. Right?
And we're recording this too early to hear the Google announcement, but it'll be very interesting to hear, because unlike Meta, Google has everything to lose for AI, and their search business could be in decline. We don't know yet. And it's a much more interesting story there, whereas Meta pretty much is all upside from AI.
That's right. I was playing with the Meta AI, just the interface to, you know, just, you know, kind of create images and everything like that. And it's great. It's like fast. It's accurate. I think it's on par with some of the other ones. I think you're right. We'll see what happens with Google. One more to close it out. This has been awesome. So Palantir, which is a company that specializes in you know, software platforms for big data analytics. Noteworthy because it was co-founded by Peter Thiel, Alex Karp, Joe Lonsdale, a bunch of guys that have done some pretty incredible stuff. And, you know, noteworthy and perhaps, you know, somewhat notorious because the U.S. government, from a defense perspective, is a big customer of Palantir. There was a story about Palantir now selling into agencies and selling in the Palantir solutions as a way to have various use cases on things like inventory planning and programmatic sales, campaign optimization. It was kind of light in terms of details, but interesting in that, you know, this company is, you know, packaging up some of these data services to agencies. And Stefan, you don't have to comment directly on, you know, if Palantir has been knocking on the doors of WTP, but since we have you on, what's your reaction or perspective on this? And if it's a no comment, totally cool.
No, I'm happy to talk about it. No, I mean, they're clearly a capable business, right? And I don't actually know the details of who they're selling to and where they're actually deploying their solutions in the wild and exactly for what use cases. But I think certainly my strategy has always been that very strong platform and vendor lock-in is not a good thing in a fast-moving, you know, innovative space. And so, you know, we've taken a far more kind of platform and you know, vendor agnostic approach in terms of building our own solutions. We obviously work with the large hyperscalers. We work with all the large foundational model companies and many of the software, you know, SaaS companies in the space. But, you know, if you really want to innovate, I think you need a lot more flexibility. You know, there's an interesting notion. One of my product managers has this riff at the moment. He, you know, when he's thinking about generative AI-based innovation, he says, you have to lean into the emerging capabilities of the new models. What he means is that you've got to explore the kind of the full extent of the impact and the applications of these new model capabilities rather than think about historical and legacy ways of doing stuff. So if you can have a million token context window for a large language model, which Gemini, you know, 1.5 gives you now, you can basically upload two volumes of War and Peace before you ask it to give you an answer, right? Part of your prompt is two volumes of War and Peace. Now, that means effectively a large part of what we used to do through ETL and things like that just go away, right? You don't need it. In fact, you don't even need robotic process automation because you can just take screenshots of screens and have GPTV or, you know, some version of you know, machine vision read the text in the screen and then input it into the next process, right? So, I mean, slightly diverging, but my point is I don't think models like that or platforms like Palantir are ideal for very fast-moving, very nimble, very agile kind of categories and industries. Probably great for defense, probably great for security, maybe great for you know, health sciences or kind of medical practitioners. But, you know, I don't think it's ideal, in my opinion, for our category.
That's awesome perspective. All right, anything on that?
No, that was, I learned something. Learned something new today.
Same here. I learned several things today.
All right, let's call it. Stefan, thank you so much for being here.
Wonderful, Larry. It's great to see you guys again.
This is
Eric, awesome. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Thank you for subscribing to Marketecture. New interviews are added every week at marketecture.tv and your favorite podcasting app.